Danny Aiello is best known for his iconic roles in movies like The Godfather Part II, Moonstruck, and Do the Right Thing, the part for which he received Golden Globe and Academy Award nominations. In his new book, I Only Know Who I Am When I Am Somebody Else, My Life on the Street, on the Stage, and in the Movies, he describes how he broke into acting at 36, admittedly by mistake, while working at Manhattan comedy club The Improvisation. He has since appeared in over 85 movies and numerous stage productions. It is a great pleasure to welcome Danny Aiello to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's nice being here.
Very nice to have you with us. I so enjoyed the stories in the book. And what I find fascinating, and I know you talk about this a lot in the book, is that even through this incredible career, you still feel like an outsider to the business.
Yeah, it's been like an up and down thing. You know, acting is a very strange kind of profession. You're employed, unemployed, employed, unemployed, employed, unemployed. So you don't sustain yourself a long period of time working because that's the way, the nature of the business. So therefore, I was always unsure. After becoming unemployed, I said, am I going to get another job? And I think that's the way all actors feel. But my life has been up and down so many damn times, you know, that it was a very difficult thing for me really to attach myself to. I've always felt like an outsider since the age of six, as a matter of fact. I had eczema. I was a kid who was sitting in the front row because I was quite small, intelligent as well. The teachers loved me, but unfortunately, I didn't love myself. It necessitated my scratching myself constantly because of eczema, and I always had the feeling that the other students in the class were looking at me with disgust. So I demanded to be, I didn't demand, but I asked and requested to be seated in the back so that I couldn't be observed scratching myself. I know it's a silly thing to say, but it was so bad that I was hospitalized, and my mother had, at night when I was home sleeping, she would have to put gloves on me or socks, depending on what we could afford at the time. I mean, it was a crazy time, and I think what happened was that sort of established for me what I was going to be throughout in life, assured of myself at times, but then again, unassured of myself at times, not quite sure of who I was, what I was doing, where, just a very confusing childhood. And that went on throughout my life, always uncertain, unsure, you know, not fitting in, trying to, but not quite.
And yet, the jobs that you would do at a very young age, whether it was shining shoes in Grand Central, or being a numbers runner, or being a pool hustler, so you're in with an adult crowd, right? I mean, you're in with the big guys.
Independent jobs, really. You'll notice I didn't do it with a group. You know, when I was running numbers, all I had to do was run to a place and get the numbers and the money that was submitted to me by the person that was, gambling. I was turning over to the book. When I was shooting pool, it was just me. I had to count on myself. Of course, there was a backer because I never had my own money. If you've seen the movie The Hustler with Paul Newman, you knew that he had always had someone backing him. And that was a man giving me money to pool at the shoot. And if I won, I got 50%. If I lost, he lost everything. I didn't lose a penny. And then, of course, delivering wash, delivering groceries, lighting stoves on the high holy days for Jewish people. I was the goya, they called me. So it was always very independently me. When I was a newsie, I was by myself. I was a marketing and merchandising expert because when I was shining shoes, I was also selling newspapers. And that wasn't to sort of gratify myself. My feeling was to give money into the house because my father was somewhat nomadic. We didn't see him often. We loved him, but we didn't see him often enough to dislike him. We didn't know him, but we loved him. I know I'm jumping all over the place, but I'm trying. That's how the book is.
It takes
you on so many different journeys, and it gets convoluted at times. But, if this book, if I may, Joe, was to sell one book, I wouldn't mind because it was the book I wanted to write.
It's fascinating because there was a point with that life on the street and taking all the different jobs where you started to get in trouble.
Yeah.
And did you realize that you were going down a path that you didn't want to go down to, which ultimately led you to enlist in the Army? Or was that just the way it happened? It wasn't that thought out?
Joe, it was just the way it happened, and I didn't realize I was going down that path until I reached the age of 17. And I realized that I'm going to get myself in a lot of trouble. I possibly end up in jail, because there was some, you know, there weren't gang leaders I was hanging out, but some tough kids in the neighborhood. We were basically a stickball team. But then once one group would fight another neighborhood, and things like that were going on. We were getting in bad fights. I mean, they picked me once up. The two detectives came into PS 98, Herman Ritter in the Bronx, this elementary high school, and they took me to the hospital saying that I was identified as someone who was instrumental in beating up this fellow by the name of Joe Arriago. Now, the guy almost died, and they told me I was going down there to be identified. If I was, I was going to be charged with attempted murder. That scared the hell out of me. They took me down there, and they sat me in a vestibule outside this guy's room. So I didn't know it at the time, but they were trying to frighten me. They didn't, of course, I wasn't involved in that thing, but my name was dropped. But I was terrified. I began to feel guilty. You know, they kept telling me I was guilty, and I began to feel it. I was only maybe, you know, 14, 15 at the time. So they go in, they see the guy, the door they left a little bit open, and I'm wondering, oh, my God, in heaven, what's happening here? They came out. They each grabbed me by my arm, took me down the stairs through Lincoln Hospital, took me back to school, and then said politely, get the F out of my car. And that was the last thing I heard. So that was the thing that frightened me enough to where I said, I got to get out of here. So I enlisted in the Army at the age of 17. And I spent 3 years in the service. But it was, you know, all the things that I was doing as a child, I got shot, I got knifed. But this happened to all the kids in the neighborhoods at that time. With a zip gun, no less. Not a real gun, but a zip gun made in shop. You know, wood shop in school. I mean, it was just crazy. But all the kids were getting in trouble. But then I did realize, old enough to realize, what am I doing? So I just wanted to change my way of life. I asked my mother. She didn't have to sign for me. I was old enough to go. And I went in at 17. And that was another life, of course, 3 years in the service, honorably discharged in 1954.
And playing a lot of baseball in this time as a way of entertaining the troops.
Yeah, I was an outstanding athlete. I think that's what got me through my childhood, because I didn't have any relationships where, you know, outside of sports, because I was always concerned with how I looked, how I scratched myself. And, you know, because when I was in school toward the end, I was the oldest kid in class, because I was left back 2 years in a row as a result of being hospitalized. So there I was with younger kids than myself looking at me with disgust. So, I mean, it was just crazy. So what I did was I played sports, and there I forgot about all those things that illed me, that you know, that created stress for me. I kept playing ball. Then at one point, at the age of 16, Mitchell Ettis, who was a New York Giants scout and also was a St. Louis Brown scout, which is now the Baltimore Orioles, and they wanted me to, like, go to Puerto Rico. They were trying, but I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't know what the hell. You know, at that time, if I knew what I was doing, I would have jumped at it. But I went into the Army instead. And when I went into the Army, I came out after 3 years, and they came after me again. And being away for 3 years, I said, no, I'm not going away with no baseball thing. And I didn't do it. But I was always an outstanding ball player. I coached football as well. I did a lot of things in sports. And it saved me from a lot of situations. You know, when I was in the Army, thought I'd have to go out in maneuvers in Germany. And because Lieutenant Edwards, who was in charge of the regimental baseball team, saw that I had the ability to play ball, and that's all I did for 2 summers. I played baseball in Germany. And, you know, I volunteered for Korea, but, you know, at the time I thought it was unfortunate. I was cut off the shipments, and I was sent to Germany, occupation. And I was there from 1952 till I got discharged. And so I came out. You know, guys were going out on maneuvers before I had gotten out. And when I was on this baseball team, I was not subjected to maneuvers or anything like that, because I was on what they call TDY. That's temporary duty, Joe. I don't do anything but play baseball. And during the winter, also on TDY, but when I was a police officer, they called it the security patrol. And so baseball did that for me. And, of course, when I come out of the service, and, well, I'll wait for you to ask me, but when I went into the improvisation in New York, as you stated, the reason I went to the improv, I lost the job as a union president for Greyhound. I was the youngest president for Greyhound in the country at that particular time. But we had a wildcat strike. It was blamed on me. I was sued for $500,000 and released. I became disillusioned because the Union International was backing management as opposed to its union membership. So I did become disillusioned. I decided not to fight the case. So I walked out, you know, and I had three kids at the time with the fourth coming. And I was floundering around with no money. And I walked into the improv. Bud Friedman, the proprietor, who's a great guy, still my friend even today, you know, recognized my talent, and he made me a bouncer. But the interesting thing is that he really wanted me to play ball for the improvisation and the Broadway show league, softball. So my feeling is, I don't know if he gave me the job because he was sorry that I needed a job and I had children, or because he wanted me to be a ringer on his softball team. He's never admitted to me yet. But that is where improvisation, Joe, this is important. I never wanted to be an actor, not because I didn't want to, but because I didn't think it was humanly possible. I thought actors when I was a kid, you know, they were like people that came from Mars, and Hollywood was like Mars to me. I never left New York or Manhattan at that time. So I didn't know anything about acting. I'm in there, and I'm watching comedians at the improv perform. And certainly, I didn't want to be a monologist, a comedian. I wasn't interested. Mm. I saw what they were doing. It was brilliant, and I knew I could never do that, nor did I want to do that. So, but I'm watching, and learning. And then partially, you know, when Bud wasn't available to MC, I would get up to MC. I didn't know what I was doing, but I would announce, here he is, ladies and gentlemen, here she is, ladies and gentlemen. But as I went on, I began to become more acquainted, you know, more, let's say, efficient with what I was doing. And I began to like being up there in front of people and talking. And then I began to do monologues on the stage to a live mic when there was no one in the audience. And I just continued to do that. Then once in a while, I would sing a song when there was no one in the audience, because I always loved to sing, not in front of people, but in the bathroom, you know, some, or in the backyard with my friends. And that's how it all evolved. And a guy by the name of Louis LaRusso II comes in, a neophyte writer, never produced anything, and certainly I'd never acted in anything. He said, Danny, I'd love you to be in my play. I said, I'm not an actor. He said, yes, you are. You just don't know it yet. And what happened was, he had written three plays for me off Broadway. One was called Lamppost Reunion, Knockout, and Wheelbarrow Closes. Joe, this is the first time, to my knowledge, that this kind of thing has ever happened. Each one of those plays went to Broadway, and I starred in each of them. He began, if not for Louis LaRusso II, may he rest in peace, I wouldn't be whoever I am today, however good or bad that is. He did it for me.
It should be said, and I want to talk more about the career and how it progressed. I mean, it was 10 years with Greyhound, and that was, you were starting a family, and this is a really tough time. But you write in the book about severe depression that you were battling as well.
Yeah, I was so, I'm a person that never runs to a doctor. And unfortunately, you usually do that when it's too late. And in this situation, I kept looking in the mirror at the age of 27. I had the four children then. And I was thinking, I began to cry. And I was thinking I was going to die. I never had these thoughts before in my life. It wasn't humanly possible for me to think that way. So at my disposal was the Kingsbridge Veterans Hospital, Kingsbridge Avenue in the Bronx. So I went there, and they showed me therapists, psychiatrists, and we're talking, and they examined me, and he says to me, Mr. Corporal Aiello, there's nothing wrong with you. So I said, Doc, look, I don't know what you're saying. All I know is that there is something. I feel sick. So he asked me if I would want to enter into their program, which required me to be in, which it's mental. You know, you're putting yourself into a ward of people who are in bad shape mentally. Yeah. I was so sick in my mind at that time, not knowing if I was going to live or die, that I said yes. And I went into this place. I was there 2 weeks. I refused all medication because they were asking me to take pills, and I was never anyone who would put anything heavier than aspirin in my mouth. So if they would give me medication, they depended on you to take it yourself, but I always pocketed it and threw it away. so I never utilized it. They put me on occupational therapy, and that therapy was I'd go out in the front lawn, which was huge, off Kingsbridge Avenue in the Bronx, and they would have a nurse, a male nurse, pitch to me, and I would be hitting shots over the fence out into Kingsbridge Avenue. During that period of time, I was safe, and I was in, you know, in my groove. It was, you know, what I loved to do. Now, when I went back in to the ward, I was sick again, and the feelings came up. And I always had this feeling in the back of my neck. I guess we would call it anxiety today. The term was not used then, Joe. So I went back in, and I noticed in that 2 weeks, I'm watching young men, some older than me, some younger, walking around like they were in a trance. And their eyes, you know, there was no look in their eyes. So most of them were looking down and not straight ahead as they were pacing the floor. And forgive me for saying this, but this is what I thought. These guys are all nuts. This isn't me. Yeah. So I'm dealing with myself. And then I have a double bunk in the ward. And there's this young guy who looks like he should be an offensive lineman for the New York Giants. Healthy looking guy who was a bus driver, city bus driver. We have normal conversations. Then at 3 o'clock in the morning, generally, he starts sobbing like crazy. I mean, this guy is sobbing. And I'm laying there and I'm saying, I'm getting out of here. They're crazy. This ain't me. And then, you know what I thought, Joe? I thought of them all looking at me and saying the same thing. They thought I was nuts. I went to the psychiatrist. I said, doctor, I said, I have to get out of here. I said, I think I'm going to go crazy. I thought he'd laugh at that, but he didn't. He looked at me, he said, well, if you do go, it's got to be AMA, which is against medical advice. I said, I don't care. Doc, I just have to get out of here. And he knew that I always had the feeling that I was going to pass out. So you know what he says to me? He says, Corporal Aiello, I'm giving you a piece of advice. Now, keep in mind, Joe, I don't know if this is effective medical advice or not, but I followed it to the letter. He said, if ever, no matter where you are, you feel like you're going to pass out, lay down. I don't care where you are. So I thought it was kind of idiotic, but here I am from 238th Street and Broadway, and I'm taking the train down to Greyhound. And I'm looking up, reading the advertising, you know, sitting. And suddenly I got the feeling in the back of my neck I was going to pass out. There was a guy next to me, and don't you know, I just collapsed and put my head right in his lap. People are looking at me, and I look perfectly healthy, but that's what I did, and it helped me, and I didn't pass out. And I always had that psychological thing. Well, man, I'm not going to be in trouble because I know I can just put my head down, and I won't pass out. Well, for 2 years, I had this feeling. 2 years, Joe. Kept going to work every day, and then God knows it went away.
Has therapy been a part of your life since then?
I'm sorry?
Has therapy been a part of your life since
never.
Then?
I'm not one of those Hollywood guys. No, I don't particularly trust those people. I don't think they know any more than I do or a good friend does. No, I'm not into that. And it's a terrible thing to say. I remember I said that to Dick Cavett once a long time ago. He was talking about psychiatry, therapists, and things because he believed tremendously in that. And we didn't argue, but we had differing opinions. And I said, no, I just... What's a guy going to tell me who's been educated in the field? What's he going to tell me? Did he experience what I've experienced? Did he talk to other people about it and he knows about experiences like that? I just, you know, I'm sure it could be helpful. I'm positive it's helped a lot of people. You have to believe in it to go to it and have it effectively, you know, take care of you. But I never believed in that, so therefore I didn't think it was ever going to be helpful. But you know something? You raised an issue, an important point. That psychiatrist gave me therapy, and that therapy was fall down,
right.
Lay down, you know, so maybe it did work to a degree. But I've never seen one, never.
And since then, you can control the anxiety, you control the depression.
Yeah, what I do is I get depressed often. I'm call it, what do you call those guys who have the up and down things? I have that. You know, I
bipolar.
Can go out and do it. Yeah, sometimes I think I'm that. I was never diagnosed with that. And my behavior is never odd, and I never bring my problems to anyone else. But I know when let's say I'm out doing a big movie or something, and I'm working for 2 months, I come home and I'm like a log. I mean, that whole wonderful thing of doing that movie, being out there, you know, the people seeing me and, you know, showing off whatever the hell it is. And I come home, I lay in bed. I can lay in bed for about 4 days. Just lay there, you know, thinking, you know, meditating. I'll tell you this, the hardest thing in my life, the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life, forget the hospitals, forget all this, was writing this book. You talk about going back, Joe. I'm 142 years old, you know, and here I go back to the age of six. How are you going to remember anything at the age of six? You know, I decided that's the starting point. It's got to start with my childhood because I want this book to serve as an inspiration to people who otherwise might think, you know, I can't change my life. I'm 40 years old. I'm this, I'm that. I'm too old to do that. I want people to read this and see the things that you can go through in life and still come out standing on your feet and achieve, you know, maybe everything that you wanted to achieve. I want it to be that. You know what I mean? And I think that I've done this with this book. And it was stressful. Going back to my youth, there are things that I buried in my life. I'm sure I buried them, not knowledgeable. You know, not anything that I was certain of. Like, I buried this. I didn't want to think of it. It just, as time went on, my brother Ralphie, who died, he was born before I was. He died at the age of 7 months and 14 days. Because he had what they called pertussis, which was whooping cough, it was a contagious kind of disease, they thought in those days. Indigent people like us, as poor as we were unable to have that taken care of in, you know, in a place where money would take care of it. They sent us to what they called Brothers Island off the East River, which was known as a leper colony because that's where they put people that were indigent, and they buried them in Potter's Field on Brothers Island or on Hart Island. That's where my brother was buried, and because he had whooping cough and indigent, didn't have money. So it's one of those things were brought up, and I put that to sleep. And one of the most devastating things about that, when my mother was going to Potter's Field to, at least we thought she was going to Potter's Field. She was to meet my father at the ferry on the East River, and they were both going over to see my brother Ralphie. And lo and behold, my father doesn't show up, which is not a new scenario that happened often. He wasn't a mean man, you know, but this happened all the time. Mm. But my mother didn't get on the ferry because of that. And what happens? The ferry was called the Observation. It goes off, and it blows up in the East River, and 72 people are killed. And the thing is that I was the next child born after that incident. About 6 months later, my mother conceived me as a child, which meant, of course, that she had been on that ferry. Danny Aiello, for better or worse, would not have been here. Mm. And it was, you know, and I want to mention that this book is not Daddy Dearest, because I've seen people kill their families, you know, after the fact. The person is dead and they're saying terrible things about them, and unfortunately that person's case is indefensible because he or she is dead and there's nothing they can say, you know, in defense of themselves. I love my father and all the children in the family, maybe with the exception of my older sister Helen, who was like my second mother. We loved him because my mother never badmouthed him, and she loved him forever, never said a bad word. We couldn't dislike my father because we didn't know him. We didn't know him enough to dislike, you know what I mean? So our love went toward him because of the things that my mother had told us. My mother was a good woman. My mother, I used to be interviewed and asking me about my mother, and I would always love to mention a name, say who she was, because I wanted people to know that she was on this earth. You know, she was legally blind and so forth from glaucoma. But Mama, I used to say to reporters like yourself, you know, you're not a reporter, well, whatever, you know, you're a radio host.
An interview, right?
An interview. And I would say my mother could have been the Pope had she been a man. She would have been the Pope. And as time goes on, you know, a little while ago, the smoke is coming out of Rome, gray smoke, white, and we're naming the Pope. And the Pope comes out, he's not quite sure what his name is. And then he decides his name is Francis, Francis. Mm-hmm. Well, my mother's name is Frances. So in the book, it's Francis, my mother, the Pope, and Francis, the real Pope, because, I mean, it sounds crazy, but I had to put that in a book. I just had to, because that's what I always said, you know, and I had to communicate this to the readers. You know how I wrote this book, Joe?
Oh.
At my kitchen table with my little Maltese, Sophie Belle, in my arm. 5 hours a day, I'd sit and I'd communicate it to Siri, the woman in my iPhone. And, of course, it wasn't all verbally done. I had to write, because she constantly misspells words. You know, I'm talking about Siri. And I make the comparison in a book at the very beginning of being a child of that part of the century. When we didn't have light, we had kerosene lamps, and we had wood-burning stoves and coal-burning stoves. And then here I am writing a book with Siri. And also, I look up into the sky and orbiting the Earth at about 18,000 miles up. My car, my Jaguar, with the license plate 29th Street, is being directed to its destination. I mean, you got to think of the things that have happened in this world since I was born. It's just fabulous when you think of it.
When it comes to the acting and it comes to the films and the roles that you've had, what are you proud of?
Well, I'm just proud of the work that I was able to do because, Joe, I never studied. And the reason I didn't study, and I'm not telling potential actors or actresses not to, because I want them to study if they have the time to do it. If they can afford to do it, do it, do it, of course. But if you can't do it, that doesn't mean that your acting possibilities are over. I'm proof of that. But it makes it a lot easier. It's a shortcut to getting to what you need in order to do a character by going to school. They give you shortcuts. I didn't have shortcuts. What I had was my life. I was able to bring from my life on the street a natural ability. I brought something natural to the screen and to the stage, and it came not as a result of being taught it, but that I was able to concentrate myself into situations that were similar to what I had done in the street or in a school or in my home. And that's how I rounded out characters. Now, if you go to school, you know, you can learn these things in a very easy way. I'm proud because I was able to do that, to accomplish that. But let me say this. Critics have been wonderful to me throughout my life. I mean, in the business, I got reviews at the beginning, and remember, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Joe, I had no idea what I couldn't construct a proper sentence if my life depended on it. What I did was, I did it on pure energy. And people were saying things like, this guy's like Brando. Of course, I'm not like Brando. There's only one Brando. But then some crazy critic said it once. The energy on this guy, and it was pure energy. I think I was fooling people. Not that I was smart enough to fool them, but that was the only way I knew how to act. So when they would critique it, Times, Daily News, Post, New York Magazine, they would call me a natural. Woody Allen used to call me a natural. And I used to sit up, and I never said this to them. I hated to be called a natural because the natural to me meant untrained, didn't go to school. Now, if you call me a natural now, that's great because I know how to act now. I learned how to act simply by doing it for an extended period of time. So, but natural then was an insult to me, but not today. You know what I mean? But the accomplishments that I made without having to study, you know, and get through all of that stuff is what I'm most proud of.
Well, the book is just beautifully written. It is I Only Know Who I Am When I Am Somebody Else. It is published by Gallery Books. Danny Aiello, I thank you very much for sharing with us.
Joe Donahue, I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to tell a little bit of the story of my book, and I truly appreciate it.
A great pleasure. Again, Danny Aiello's book is I Only Know Who I Am When I Am Somebody Else. It's published by Gallery Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.